So tonight we're talking about equanimity, the fourth of the four Ramaviharas. How many of you have been attending the whole series of classes on the Ramaviharas?
No.
Okay. How many of you know what the four Ramaviharas are? You're doing better there. So, Brahma is a Sanskrit and Pali word that basically means God, and Vihara is a dwelling place. So, it's the Brahma Viharas are the plural, the where the gods dwell, and they're referring to attitudes, approaches. Ways of living. So, the four divine abodes is what Brahma Viharas translates to. And so, when you hold these attitudes, when you practice the Brahma Viharas, when they become a part of who you are and how you live your life, then you are dwelling in the divine abode. So those four, for those of you that don't know, first is loving kindness, and that's the foundation. The second is compassion. The third is sympathetic joy. And the fourth is equanimity. And so, together they create a rather wonderful way of being and being in the world and of seeing the world. And tonight we're talking about equanimity. So hopefully for those of you that haven't been for the other classes and didn't put your hand up that you knew what the four Ramaviharas were, hopefully we can acquaint you with all of them without boring the ones that have been coming to the classes regularly. Loving kindness. I think that's pretty straightforward, right? It's coming from a place of love, of caring. And there is a particular meditation that's called loving kindness meditation. Or metta. You may have heard of it before, metta meditation. And it's a way of cultivating this attitude of loving kindness. Loving kindness towards everyone, towards yourself, towards all those people that are close to you, that you love and care for, but also all kinds of people everywhere. And all kinds of beings everywhere, including the ones that you don't necessarily get along with. Learning to have feelings of loving kindness towards your enemies is a very important part of this practice. The second is compassion. So loving kindness is something that you feel towards people, and that you wish for them. You wish for them to be free from suffering. You wish for them to be free from ill will. You wish for them, for each of them, to be filled with loving kindness and know the pleasure and happiness that comes from feeling love and caring for other beings. And you wish for them that they all be truly happy. So compassion takes us to the next step. It's not just wishing this and feeling this, it's compassion is about doing something. So when you feel compassion for somebody because of their suffering, what you do is you want to take some kind of action. If it's possible, if there's something you can do to ease their pain or relieve their suffering, you do. So compassion is, it's that urge to help, to actually do something. And of course it's following through on that urge and actually doing something. Which is not the same as sympathy. Or pity. It's wanting to actually do something. And sympathetic joy, I know that's kind of an odd phrase, but what it means is taking pleasure in the happiness, the success, the well-being of others. And this is a very wonderful thing that you, a wonderful attitude to have, because, you know, you can only have so many good experiences yourself. But if you can learn to take enjoyment and satisfaction in the experiences of other people, you multiply the potential for your own joy enormously. And so that's what sympathetic joy is learning to be happy for others. And of course, the wonderful thing about it is that if seeing other people happy makes you happy, then you can make yourself happy by doing things to make other people happy. It just keeps on going. So sympathetic joy is an extension beyond loving kindness and compassion. So if loving kindness is the basis, is the foundation, equanimity is the pinnacle. It's the ultimate refinement. And that's the main thing that we're planning to talk about tonight. So, what is equanimity? How many people know what equanimity is? It's a few people, yeah. Probably more than have put their hands up. Well, I'd like to hear from somebody what it means to you, or what you think it means. Actually, it'd be great to hear from somebody perhaps instead of just giving me a formal definition, tell me what you think it means and what it means to you. Yes.
A balanced or evenness of spirit.
Balance or evenness of spirit. That's very good, and that's equa. That's the equa part of equanimity. Yeah, that's right. Balanced in what way?
I guess not overly affected by the good and the bad, or not. I've gone through periods of great elation and great depression, and my idea is to experience life without either one of those. That's what I mean by balance. Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly, neither one of those corresponds to equanimity. They're unbalanced. Yeah. So that's definitely a meaning of it. Yes.
Well, knowing that that samsara is not ultimately satisfying would automatically make you more equanimous?
That's precisely the right word. Yeah, it makes you more equanimous.
So, it's like if something good happens, you don't really know whether it's good or not. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, well, you know, the story of the horse that what happened? It ran away, and then it brought back more horses, and that was good. And then the son tried to break one of the horses, and he broke his leg, and that was bad. And then the army came to conscript the son, but he had a broken leg, so he couldn't be conscripted, so that was good. You know, it was like, you don't really know. I mean, that's sort of accepting samsara and saying that it is unsatisfactory, or it is unpredictable. It changes.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's some ideas.
Well, that's great. Actually, I hadn't heard that story before, and I really liked it.
Oh.
Because what it's saying is that, and this is definitely to do with equanimity, it's that we'd like to believe that we're capable of accurately judging the goodness and badness of things, of people, of what happens, and so on and so forth. And what that story is pointing out, of course, is that you never know. You never really know. and that we're all making, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we go through the world thinking we can judge things as good or bad. But if we're honest with ourselves and look, we make a lot of mistakes, and we're not really capable of the level of discernment that we imagine we are. And so an aspect of equanimity would certainly be recognizing that and knowing this, and not trusting the impulsive judgments that might come up, and also not overestimating our ability to adequately discern the goodness or badness of anything. That is definitely an aspect of equanimity. Also, you said something you said earlier on. When things that we think are good happen, then we want to cling to them. And when things that we think are bad happen, then we want to make them stop. We want to prevent them. Things that are pleasant, we are drawn towards, and things that are unpleasant, we have aversion towards. And this is the opposite of equanimity. This is a reactivity that is based on the simple formula: if it feels good, I want more of it. If it doesn't, I want to get rid of it. I might even want to destroy the cause of it. And that's precisely the opposite of equanimity. One way that we could define equanimity is to be free of that kind of reactivity and accept the pleasant and the unpleasant as they arise on their own terms, without pursuing the one or trying to do something to prevent or control the other. So, other thoughts about equanimity?
Having an awareness of the selflessness of the thing or the object, regardless whether it's an unpleasant or a pleasant situation or object.
Equanimity, in that sense, are you meaning when something makes us happy or unhappy, realizing it's not the thing that's responsible for our happiness or unhappiness? Is that what you mean?
Well, no, it's not quite. It's when something appears, whether it's your own thought or somebody else, that there's an awareness of the emptiness of that, or the selflessness of that, immediately arises with the object. Therefore, regardless whether that thought or that situation is happy or sad, there's an undercurrent of knowing its nature, which will temper the emotional reaction to it.
So you have equanimity towards any thought or any event or even any feeling. You have equanimity towards it because you understand the emptiness and the selfless nature of it. Yeah, right. So, and so we can talk about equanimity, we can talk about the different things that give rise to equanimity. And so we've already addressed one of them. The degree to which you understand, the degree to which you have insight into the way things really work, you begin to have equanimity. When you realize that what might appear to be pleasant or good might turn out not to be, you have equanimity. When you realize that something that might appear to be unpleasant or bad might turn out not to be, then you have equanimity. When you begin to understand that it's our craving that causes our suffering, then when something good or bad happens, you have equanimity rather than reacting to it out of desire or aversion. When you realize that all phenomena are empty and without self, then you have equanimity towards all things, right? So this is all equanimity that comes from insight. As your understanding deepens, your potential for equanimity increases. Now, does that mean that if you understand all these things that you'll have equanimity? That's your experience, right? Once somebody's explained this to you, after that, you have equanimity. No, it doesn't. Because although you may understand emptiness, you may understand no self, you may understand the nature of suffering and the cause of suffering, you may understand them intellectually. You might be able to give a brilliant lecture on them. That doesn't mean when you're confronted with a situation in life that you will be equanimous at all. Because it's not the part of your mind that does intellectual understanding that determines how you react to things when they actually arise. And so that's an important point, because I said understanding and I said insight. So equanimity, it's very helpful to have understanding. It's very helpful because then you can work on cultivating equanimity. You can practice being equanimous. You can do practices that help you to develop equanimity. But understanding is not going to make you equanimous. It's going to be helpful. But insight, what we use the term insight for, is not intellectual understanding. It goes much deeper than that. Because you may understand something intellectually, but your gut level reaction is a totally different story. And to have insight into something is to have that deep shift in the way that you intuitively perceive things and the way you spontaneously respond to things as a result of that intuitive understanding. So insight gives rise to equanimity. That's one of the causes of equanimity. Let's bring it back to the Brahma Viharas. What does equanimity have to do with loving kindness? Yes?
Well, the aversion and graspy spikes also apply to people. So when you have equanimity across people, it means that people who you don't like, you don't feel so much aversion to, and you try and avoid, and people who you really like, you don't try and be so graspy about. Mm-hmm. So the equanimity provides an equality of your treatment and loving kindness and sympathetic joy and wish for no ill will, so that it is across all beings and not just the ones you like.
Absolutely. Well said. Well put. And when we do loving kindness meditation, we start out by feeling loving kindness for the people that are easy, the people that have been have supported us, that we love, that we feel really good about. But then we work towards being able to generate loving kindness towards the people we don't like, those we don't get along with. So in doing the loving kindness, the metta meditation practice, part of the practice involves developing equanimity. And this is the balance. This is the equalness in it. Is that it's very easy to feel loving kindness towards some people, but when you can feel loving kindness towards everybody, now you've brought equanimity into it. So you're loving kind without equanimity, your loving kindness is rather limited. But the practice of loving kindness, you might ask the question, well, how do we develop equanimity? And one of the ways is by practicing loving kindness and practice directing your loving kindness towards the people that it's not easy to feel loving kindness towards. It's a very, very important and very powerful practice. So. Same thing with sympathetic joy. It's really easy to feel sympathetic joy towards somebody you love. Now, feeling sympathetic joy towards somebody else who got the promotion you wanted, that's a bigger challenge, right? Yeah. To feel sympathetic joy at a wedding when you were hoping you'd be one of the people up front. That's a big challenge. That takes a lot of equanimity. But don't we all know and recognize the value of that? So equanimity, by practicing sympathetic joy, by practicing compassion towards people that you don't have sympathy for. And that's one of the things that I don't know if you had a chance to talk about that previously, the difference between compassion and sympathy. But if you practice having compassion towards people that you don't have sympathy for, you know what I'm saying, right? If you do that, you're developing equanimity. You don't do that, you don't have equanimity. What you're doing is still good. It's still good to have compassion. But it's when you're really applying it in the best way, you're having compassion for those that you don't feel in line with, you don't feel connected to, that perhaps at the same time that you're trying to act out of compassion, there's some other part of your mind that's busy judging and condemning and so on and so forth. So, see how I'm just trying to point out how equanimity fits into the other practices of the Brahma Vihara, and that while you're practicing any of the Brahma Viharas, if you're doing the practice properly, you're developing equanimity. And the more you do it, the more equanimity that you're going to have. Good night. Thank you for coming.
Is there another component to the equanimity? Say you have compassion for someone, but you cannot alleviate their suffering. Does the equanimity come into play at that point?
It certainly does, and that's a very important aspect of equanimity. And some people might think that compassion means that when you see somebody else suffering, you suffer. But that's not what it means. You see somebody suffering and you want to help them and do something about it. But sometimes there's nothing that you can do. Or sometimes you try to do something and it doesn't succeed. You need to have equanimity. It's very difficult to practice compassion if you don't have equanimity, because otherwise you're going to create a lot of suffering for yourself. Equanimity is a really important part of equanimity is accepting what is. You know how your own suffering arises because of your rejection of what is, your wanting things to be different than the way they are. When loving kindness or compassion in particular, causes you to suffer, it's because you lack equanimity. Or when you do something to try to help somebody and it doesn't work, or maybe they even refuse to accept the help, or hopefully it won't happen, but you do something intending to help and it actually makes things worse, you know. In that case, you definitely want to learn from it, not make the mistake again, same mistake again. But equanimity allows you to accept things as they are. Equanimity is, you know, don't you just love that serenity prayer that the 12-step program uses? To accept the things that you cannot change. That's the equanimity part. And to change the things that you can change. And of course the wisdom to know the difference. But equanimity is absolutely essential. You have to come from this place of doing the best that you can, but not being attached to outcome. Being just totally non-attached to outcomes. It's in that way that what you do is most maximally effective. And it's what allows you to continue. Because if you take on other people's suffering, the degree that you take on their suffering for yourself, how much good are you going to be to them? So you need to have that equanimity. Yeah?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to phrase this, but as I have acquired what could possibly be some equanimity, I've slid away from the tendency that Bob described to have mania and depression. And I realize now that having had these extremes between which I would bounce, that was what I thought was feeling. Mm-hmm. And now that I don't bounce off walls in either direction, it isn't true that I don't feel, but it's so different. I'm really resisting using the word as an illusion of not feeling, because I don't really get provoked one direction or another. There's not huge euphoria, and there's not wrist-slashing grief.
Right.
And now that I don't have those, how do we know we've not lost our ability to feel?
You've raised something that is very important. We should talk about is equanimity versus indifference versus apathy. What's the difference? Is equanimity indifference?
Well, I've been indifferent, and I don't think so.
No, equanimity absolutely is not indifferent. As a matter of fact, when you've been very depressed, then you've been indifferent. Actually, if you've been manic, you're probably pretty indifferent then, too. equanimity is a totally different thing from indifference or apathy. This thing about feeling. Maybe that's why we work our way to equanimity through loving kindness. Loving kindness is all about generating strong positive feeling. It's not about, and I actually think, and tell me if you disagree with me, I think it's pretty hard to go through the motions of loving kindness without having some real feeling. I mean, you can do it as a kind of play acting thing, but loving kindness is really about having the feelings, right?
Well, you've hit exactly the concern that I am going through the ritual of my loving kindness practice, but is it real? Or am I just faking it? That's exactly the concern.
So, yeah, you've done the practice, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I've done it really well yet.
That doesn't matter. You've done the practice. Most of you have done loving kindness practice in some form or another, have you not? I actually don't know how you could. The nature of the practice is to generate these feelings and to feel them as intensely as you can. And each time you practice, to try to bring up those feelings even more strongly than you did in the past. And that's how you know if you're practicing correctly, is that you do. You feel them more easily and you feel them more strongly. And you start to feel them when you're not sitting on the cushion doing formal practice, right?
Right, but if you have, as I do, a little gremlin devil's advocate in your head who is always watching, you just sit there saying, oh, but this is just...
Well, it's good to have a mask on.
But my imp says, oh, but this is just wonderful method acting. You're not really serious, are you?
And that is one of that's one of the things that gets raised all the time when you introduce people to these formal practices of things like loving kindness. Is they object, say, well, but this is just make believe. This isn't real. This is just make believe. And you can't deny that it is. But it's not. It's not just make believe. It's not only make believe.
You've hit it. You've answered me. You got it.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful saying that fits here. You don't have to believe. You just have to play along.
Yeah. That covers it quite well. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not about not feeling at all. The equanimity that you develop, if you develop through loving kindness practice, there should be no question that it's not indifference, it's not apathy. Same thing with compassion. You know, now you could carry out the physical acts of compassion and not feel anything, but that's not really what it's about, right? I don't think you could even fool yourself for very long at all. You know exactly what you were doing. Yeah, I'm doing this thing for this person, but I really don't care. It would become obvious. And same thing, sympathetic joy. I mean, we've experienced the hollowness of that, right? It's the wedding we did attend when we didn't have equanimity. So equanimity, when it comes to feelings, the feelings are genuine, but they're all of a very wholesome sort. They're not of the unwholesome, grasping, needy, desiring, averse, angry, you know. So the feelings are real. So what you're cultivating is genuine feelings, but of absolutely the right kind. And then equanimity is allowing to you to use those in a proper way, effectively. Yes?
The way I've been experiencing equanimity isn't that I don't react It's that I'm more aware of my reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And whether positive or negative, I start watching it. And, you know, I know I'm reacting, but it seems like I'm more able to, I don't know how to say it. I'm maybe reacting and profoundly, but I'm just more aware of it, so that makes it less scary or mm-hmm. less, I'm less drawn into it, part of me. I don't know, maybe I'm splitting myself apart a little bit, but I'm seeing it happen more than I used to, and that makes the whole thing sort of crystallized, so I don't drown in it.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And that's, you are practicing equanimity when you do that. You see yourself reacting rather than totally just submersing yourself into it, becoming your own reactions. You see what's happening. And you have split yourself. I mean, you haven't split yourself. You realize the nature of yourself, which is multi-part. And you're allowing some parts of yourself to observe what's happening from a more equanimous point of view, which makes the reaction less intense.
Right, it's much better.
And sometimes it allows you, even though the emotions arise, it allows you not to act on them, or at least to moderate how you act on them, right?
Yeah, well, they also seem to, once you really look at things, they change and they go away. I mean, sometimes, I mean, once you have adrenaline going, there's not much you can do. You have to just wait till it sort of subsides,
Okay. And
you can watch it. But sometimes you start to react to something, and it just sort of, you just watch it shrivel up, you know, and it goes, mm-hmm. It's not there anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. Seems more pleasant than before.
Right. So you're exercising the equanimity that you do have. And as a result of that, you're generating more equanimity. You'll have more equanimity next time as a result. Would you not agree?
Yeah, I'll try not to cling to it.
Yeah. And that is how we become more equanimous, by exercising the equanimity that we have. Yes.
And now I'm going to be the 2-year-old in the back seat. Are we there yet? How do you tell when it becomes by such remarkably small degrees, this grain of sand at a time? Oh, I got that one up, and I missed that one.
What are you going to do once you get there?
I don't know, but I expect there to be lots and lots of lights and fireworks. I mean, it's going to show.
Okay. Well, you need a little more equanimity. Which, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. That's a statement that comes from equanimity, right?
Mm.
Yeah. It comes from not being attached.
And I thought that just came out of dog training.
Yeah, well.
Okay, well, point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it seems like I'm trying to learn a way of life here, so it's not a matter of getting to some destination. I mean, it's just, well, you know, if it were, then it seems like then my life would be over once I got there. So, you know, I want to learn a way of living. And it's, I guess it doesn't work for me to think of it in terms of doing something that's headed for completion. Like, then it's done with, and then where am I? If it's my life, then my life is over when I get there. So I don't want to look at it that way. It's kind of tempting because, you know, I think of things as, you know, having a beginning and a middle and an end, and it's kind of a logical way of thinking that kind of wants to superimpose itself on everything that happens. But I don't, you know, for me, it's not productive for me to look at that. Then I tend to lose track of the idea that I want to do this every day, you know, and if I can be compassionate every day and have equanimity every day, well, then that's, it's not like I'm getting anywhere in particular, but it's something that, just a way of living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Where you're getting to is where you are at any given time. Even when we reach a destination, it's not very long before we start looking for another one, right? Start thinking where to go next. And even if you think of something as a goal that you're working towards, it may seem to you as though there's nothing past that, but isn't it always the case that once you get there, there's something more that you couldn't see from where you were before? So it's not about destinations, it's more about the way stations along the way. But the important thing is the balance between having a goal and allowing yourself to become attached to it. So it's good to have goals. It's bad to be attached to them. Okay? Instead, there's a balance there.
I read something the Dalai Lama said. He said, good fortune is not something like not forever. Consequently, it is unwise to become too attached to things turning out well.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he says a lot of good things like that.
Yeah. So the origin of the desire and aversion really starts back when we have that first pleasant, unpleasant. As you meditate longer and longer, do you just do less of that, or as other people have said, you see it happening, or do you come to a point where things just kind of roll and you don't even categorize it? You don't even have that pleasant, unpleasant feeling, the dhamma or whatever, that right at the beginning. I mean, what happens?
Okay. You will always have the experience of pleasant and unpleasant. Let's say, in Dharma talk, that's called vedana, feeling. And every experience, physical or mental, has a feeling associated with it. It's either pleasant or unpleasant, or the third possibility is that it's neither, it's neutral. And that doesn't change. You're never going to, you're not trying to go to a place, and you're never going to arrive at a place where you no longer experience the feelings of pleasant and unpleasant in association with things. But what is going to change is the way your mind reacts to pleasant and unpleasant. Because the way we're programmed from birth is to react to the pleasant with desire and the unpleasant with aversion. And what you're moving towards is to be able to experience the pleasant and unpleasant with neither desire nor aversion, but with equanimity. And so this is one definition of equanimity, is the cessation of craving, the cessation of the impulse to move through desire or aversion. And so this is the ultimate equanimity. You have all kinds of different degrees of equanimity. When you watch yourself reacting and you restrain from perhaps saying and doing something, that's one degree of equanimity. But the greatest degree of equanimity is when you have experiences, but you do not react to those experiences through craving. So that's the highest level of equanimity. So really what we're talking about is that point of reaction, that compulsive grasping to and the compulsion to act. And the emotions we feel, the emotions are a part of that. When something happens that's pleasant or painful, the emotions that it elicits, they're already part of the reaction to that. So what we're talking about with equanimity is having a different kind of reaction. But just as when talking about the Brahma Viharas, that equanimity is not one of indifference. Likewise, equanimity is not one of not experiencing pleasant and unpleasant. As a matter of fact, the more equanimity that you have, the more fully you can experience the pleasant. On the other hand, the more equanimity that you have, the less you will generate mental suffering in reaction to physical discomfort. So this is the change that takes place at the level of feeling. You still have pleasant feelings, but you experience them totally because there's no grasping. There's no desire getting in the way of you experiencing the pleasant. But on the other hand, with the unpleasant, the unpleasant aspect of it remains the same. When you hit your thumb with a hammer, or when your partner dies, that's still unpleasant. But what's absent is the huge reaction of your mind that makes that event into such a terrible thing, such a cause of suffering. Very important aspect of equanimity. Actually, the experience of nirvana, that sought-after experience where craving and mental formation cease, that happens because you have strong enough equanimity. That moment, it happens as a result of the moment where your equanimity is strong enough that your mind doesn't continue the process of grasping. It interrupts the chain at the point of craving. And if you're familiar with the description of the chain, what we're talking about here are the links of dependent origination. So there is contact, could be mental or physical, but there's contact of the sense organ with the sense object, and there's consciousness. Thank you. I'll stop soon. Contact is followed by feeling. Feeling is followed by craving, craving by clinging and becoming. The point at which the process is interrupted is after the contact has occurred, after the feeling has arisen, but instead of the craving arises, that the equanimity, if your equanimity is strong enough, then you will enter into that very special state, that cessation state that is called nibbana or nirvana. So that's a role of equanimity. The one way of describing the conditions that are required for that event to take place is it's a convergence of equanimity and insight. Both have to be equally strong, and when they are strong enough at that point of convergence, then you have that experience. Now we're past that. There was one other little aspect of equanimity that I was going to mention, and I just mentioned it briefly. Keeping you over time. Is that okay? It has to do with the perceived duality of self and other. And this is both a way to practice equanimity, to develop equanimity, is also a way that you experience equanimity, is to cease to make the kind of distinction we usually do between self and other. To see yourself and others in a completely equal and balanced way. Which is to say that equanimity doesn't mean that you hold everyone else higher than yourself. It means that you hold anyone else, everyone else, you hold yourself the same way you do. So anyone else, no difference, no distinction between self and other. The best way to, you know, if you wonder, well, what's that like? What's it like to hold myself at the same level that I hold somebody else? It's as though it's the attitude of a mother towards her children. She loves both children, or all three of them, or all 16 of them, whatever it is, equally, or at least ideally she does. We're talking ideally here, not real people. Ideally, she doesn't value any one of her children more than she does the other, or favor one more than the other. Her concern is for the maximum well-being of all of them. And equanimity, that is the attitude that equanimity allows you to have in anything that is, you know, self and other in the balance, in the scales, are seen completely equal. You don't favor one over the other. So that's it. Okay. So I won't keep you here any longer. Thank you.